Blog Talk Radio.
Elite and its impact on the people of the world.
I'd like to start you off in terms of looking at the International Convention of the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide, its definition that was defined back on December the 9th, 1948. It set up the UN definition of genocide under the resolution of genocide, Assembly Resolution 260A3, Article 2. And it states that in the present convention, genocide means anything of the following acts committed with the intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethical, racial, or religious group, such as killing members of the group, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part, or imposing measures intent to prevent birth within the group. And the last one is forcefully transferring children of the group to another group. That's a general outline of the definitions and some of the characteristics of how the United Nations, how they have defined what is genocide. We'd like to have this question displayed to the world and have a discussion today on, is genocide the only option of the powerful and the elite? With us to discuss this particular question, we have with us Brother Haki of the African Awareness Association, with Brother Anthony Williams of the All African People Revolutionary Party GC, Africa on the Move youth student, Jabari Robinson, with Friends of the Congo, Paul Pumphrey, and Brother Robert Moses, community organizer and activist. They will be giving their views and their perspectives on this question, the issue of genocide. And we would like to invite you to call in, audience, to call in at 323-679-0841. When you call in and you'd like to speak to that question or have a comment, make sure you hit the number 1. And we will acknowledge your last 4 numbers in your phone. So right now, with all of this killing going on, some systematically, some sporadic, some intentional, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, let's speak truth to the power as we'll take our first panelist tonight, Brother Haki from the African Women Association. I'd like for you, Brother Haki, to address the question, what is your position on? Is genocide the only choice for the elite and the powerful?
Historically, the question of genocide or the mass murder, of its citizenry or those that they don't particularly like has always been a weapon of choice by those who are powerful. I think this question is particularly acute when you look at the United States. Often many of us believe that, in fact, the United States is a democracy. In fact, if you understand the Constitution, then you understand the United States is not a democracy, but, in fact, it is a republic. When you look at the preamble to the Constitution, one of the things it's very, very clear on is that the U.S. is, in fact, a republic. Now, for people who don't understand implications in terms of what is a republic, it's important they understand a republic is a government set up for the concerns of the very powerful. In other words, what the powerful want, they get, because government is geared to cater specifically toward those who are powerful or the capitalist class in society. So there's a notion that, in fact, that we're democratic to the extent that we're egalitarianistic, that the greatest good for the greatest number of people doesn't exist, because republic doesn't deal with them. Republic is only concerned with the maintenance of power among those who are very, very wealthy or the capitalist class. So this is the thing we have to understand. So in that vein, one of the things I understand is that historically, when we talk about this question in terms of genocide, the U.S. has been adamantly opposed to genocide. Now, historically, one of the things that the convention raised was the question: genocide would it be compared culturally, or will you compare it politically? Now, the U.S. had no problem in terms of culturally, because they could simply commit all kind of atrocities against African people within its borders. under the guise that, in fact, that they're motivated clearly by politics. So this issue in terms of, so culturally speaking, one of the things that it doesn't do, it doesn't want to deal with the fact that you have policies, specific policies geared toward the marginalization, the humiliation, the destruction of African people within the context of North America. So we understand that the United States government is not committed to equal justice, equal fairness, or longevity as it relates to African people. And so we have to understand that. Now, the thing is that when we talk about the prevention and punishment of crime of genocide, the convention, prevention and punishment of crime of genocide, one of the things that essentially they had 9 articles. And even though, Brother Africa, you alluded to Article Number 2, which is very apropos in terms of the kind of injustices inflicted upon African people, but Article 3 comes a bit closer in terms of really encapsulating why this government would, in fact, commit genocide against African people as a way of maintaining, you know, its longevity. In particular, when we talk about Article 3, when we talk about forcibly transferring children or that group to another group, that is something that's been going on recently over the last 5 years, in which little African kids who are in foster care being denied guardianship by their grandparents and given to white people. Now, clearly, this is a problem in terms of, you know, the kid's desire or need in terms of, you know, some guidance in terms of, you know, his or her history. And so that kind of history can certainly be provided by the grandparents. But what's happening is that history that empowers the child is being denied that child, and African kids are systematically being given to white families. But that in itself is problematic. Now, one of the things when we talk about Article 3, when we talk about imposing measures intended to prevent births within a group, one of the things I think historically we're very, very clear on Margaret Sanger in terms of the whole drive in terms of birth control. Now, the thing that Margaret Sanger's whole motivation in terms of birth control had nothing in terms because she's concerned about the greater good for the great number of people. Her primary motivation was to minimize the number of African people in America. So, fortunately, that policy wasn't able to be sustained. But the government had did something that's equally as detrimental to the African community in terms of birth rates, and that is what they do is that they create a situation where access to food or access to shelter becomes lacking, and so as a consequence, you know, no food or shelter or access to food or shelter. Then that means that in terms of births, it complicates that quorum in terms of people actually wanting to have children. Now, clearly people have children out of wedlock, but in terms of the numbers, but you look at the numbers in terms of the birth among African people actually been declining. But what is very, very interesting is that when you talk about those births that actually do come to fruition, we look at the high mortality rate in terms of African babies in America, and we ask ourselves the question, so why has this happened? In fact, this is the exact relationship. What's happening is the exact relationship in terms of the kind of policies that are being taken, that are being utilized by the U.S. government in terms of making sure that the material needs of the mother, be it food, shelter, or whatever, is lacking, and therefore to increase the amount of stress subjected among African women to ensure that, in fact, the baby be born with all kinds of medical problems, which increases the probability that they won't make it. So as a consequence, the infant mortality rate goes up. So this is one of the things that they do that's insidious in terms of doing. And one thing we have to understand when we talk about the convention on genocide, we have to understand that a lot of the process in terms of genocide doesn't have to be when it just outright go out and just kill, you know tens of thousands of people at a time. It doesn't have to work that way. If you can demonstrate that this is a systematic problem, that what they're doing is systematic, that what they do, the kind of policy they adopt, that it does have a deleterious or negative impact on African people, then we can make the case, in fact, that that's genocide. So my position is that genocide is very much apropos in terms of U.S. government policies, and as the economy continues to deteriorate, it must be even more so. And so I think what people in this society have to be concerned about, and particularly African people, I think they really have to be concerned about the point where we had a situation where we had the media actually creating this counterculture in terms of African people, which says that, in fact, African people are, in fact, criminal-minded, and so, therefore, they're the root of the problem that the country faces. I mean, you and I understand that African people have no control of the economy. We don't give tax shelters to giant corporations. We don't encourage corporations to move abroad. We don't create automation for the purpose of eliminating, you know, the workforce. We don't say that people shouldn't have jobs or the enhanced profits. And, in fact, we're in opposition to those kind of things because we're more humane in terms of our understanding of humanity. But these are the kind of policies that are adopted by the U.S. government, which means that at some point, those people, African people who are set up to be victims, at some point, people in society, in fact, will act, you know, under the guise of carrying out the government's will. So this is a very, very danger that we face in, you know, as African people in America. So to answer your question, yes, no question about it. When you talk about genocide, the U.S. has been very complicit in terms of the genocidal process. And so even though they're very surreptitious about it, it's very, very clear when you look at the numbers in terms of socioeconomic indicators that as it relates to African people, we're consistently at the bottom, which has a real adverse impact on not only our numbers but also our psychology and also, you know, just our physical existence in terms of being on this planet. So, yes to your question.
Okay. You know, one of the things in your presentation, Brother Aki, I think you alluded to or you're really talking about, I think one of the key operative words is systematic. Just this whole act is systematic, systematically laid out to cause harm and damage to a group or a part of a group. And on that, what I would like to do is go to our next panelist, Brother Paul Pumphrey from Friends of the Congo, and I'd like to get his perspective on this question. Genocide is the only choice for the powerful elite. Brother Paul, welcome to Africa on the Move. What is your perspective on this theme, this question?
Yes, thank you very much. Well, I think there are a number of things that we need to look at when we start talking about what is going on, because too often what is being explained to us by way of the news media is a diversion from having people really understand what has been happening. Our case in point, if we look at what's been going on out there in Missouri, we have to look at it from a historical perspective, and then from a historical perspective, look at how each thing that's taking place leads to something else that's taking place. For example, Missouri, being a former slave state, was really a part of the old South. In fact, all the way up until the 60s, most blacks refused to even live in St. Louis itself. They would live in East St. Louis on the other side of the Mississippi River, which was Illinois. And if they worked in St. Louis, go to St. Louis, work, and then come back to East St. Louis to go back to live because of the racism and the contradictions in Missouri. The same thing happened on the western part of the state where Kansas City is located. Blacks pretty much stayed in Kansas City, Kansas, and came into Kansas City, Missouri to work and then go back across the border into Kansas to live. When you look at around about the 70s, you had a situation where a number of blacks had started moving into St. Louis proper, but St. Louis County still was lily white. It was a county in which housed, a lot of people called it WashU, was Washington University, and it was a place where people knew that the upper middle class white community was located in the county of St. Louis. When at that time you had factories such as General Motors had a factory there, McDonnell Douglas had a factory there, Kodak had a factory there, you still had the brewery of Anheuser-Busch was located in that area, and so many of the whites who had those union jobs came and worked in those factories and then retreated back across into the county line to live. It was considered an upper middle class white community. As those factories shut down, many whites moved out of the county of St. Louis pursuing jobs elsewhere. But they realized that other whites
were not willing to come in and pay the kind of price that they wanted to get for their homes because there were no jobs for them to have in the St. Louis County area. So many people began to sell their homes to the black community that had lived in St. Louis because the black community saw moving into the county of St. Louis was a, quote, moving up, as the old Jefferson, moving up, kind of like moving on up TV show used to be on. And so many blacks, middle class, began to buy homes in St. Louis County. Another thing happened was that many of the people who had been renting apartments in St. Louis County also moved out. And so either those apartment complexes were sold or the people began to take in Section 8 and inviting black people to come in to continue to generate the income that those apartment buildings were taking since many of them became vacant. When you look at Ferguson, Ferguson was somewhat of an exception to the rule in St. Louis County because St. Louis County, even today, is not majority black, but Ferguson is. It has 67% black population. When those factories moved out, the retail businesses began to demand upon the local government, both in St. Louis County as in Ferguson, tax cuts because they said they weren't making the profits they were making before. And when the government gave them those tax cuts, that meant that the government did not have the kind of revenue they were getting from those retail businesses. To make up the difference, the St. Louis County government, along with governments like Ferguson, began to change the laws in the traffic code in which they began to raise the fines for traffic violations and then basically had their police department, as they saw blacks coming into the county because someone maybe be coming to visit a family member or whatever, they began to pull them over and doing traffic stops and charging them with violation of a crime and then telling them they had to pay for that fine on the spot or risk being put under arrest and having their car impounded. That has happened to such a level that in St. Louis County today, 90% of all traffic stops are being done against the black community. Yet the black community in St. Louis County only makes up about 40 to 45% of the population. When you look at the revenue that was generated from those stops, from the towing cars, from the impoundment cars, the actual St. Louis County generates one-fourth of its budget off of those traffic stops. So what they have done is a way to shift the burden that these large corporations put on that community from spending it evenly amongst the community. They have decided that they will have the black population be super exploited by these fines that they were giving them on these petty traffic violations, as well as by charging them the cost of their cars being impounded, as well as the cost of their cars being towed after they would arrest them on these traffic violations. Those combination of things created a tremendous amount of anger and frustration in that community. And then when the situation happened with Michael Brown, where you have, again, this white policeman pulling him over on a so-called petty violation of traffic, and that's him supposedly walking in the street instead of the sidewalk. And then the officer shoots at him out of his own vehicle and then gets out of the vehicle and empties his gun on a man who has his hands up was the last straw, which led to people saying no more. But it needs to be made clear, because this is something the media spent very little time talking about, is the background which led to that situation. And we have to understand that when we start talking about genocide, there's often an economic benefit to the elite of society from the genocidal acts. Even when we look at World War II, the white German business interests wanted to extract the wealth that had been collected by the Jewish community in Germany, and they used the genocidal acts in Germany against the Jews to get that wealth. They stole their artwork. They stole their bank accounts. They stole their businesses to transfer that wealth from those who were in power, from those who did not have power. And this is basically what's going on. It's not the issue of, as they often like to make it look like, oh, they were just bad guys. No, it's an economic basis to how these policies are being promoted and pushed. And through this economic base is how we can understand how we can build a united front to attack the real enemies of society, and those are the people who have had been given by society a legal right to steal and kill. As you look at the police department, whose main role is to protect the interests of the powerful bourgeoisie in society, and this is why they get a pass so often when they kill people in the process of protecting the interests of the bourgeoisie, we must demand that this must stop, that these passes given to the protectors of the bourgeoisie must be taken away, and that if they're going to do something that violates the human rights of our society, then they should be held accountable for it. The same type of practice is going on right now in the Congo. When you see the only area of the Congo in which genocidal acts are taking place, that since 1996, this estimate is as high as 8 million people have been killed, is the area of the Congo that has $24 trillion worth of minerals that U.S. and European corporations believe belongs to them, even though they never bought the minerals or paid for it. And they use organizations like the World Bank to actually be the instrument to set up the rules for how these corporations can rob from the Congo. And one good example of that is that the World Bank does all the letting of the contracts for mining in the Congo. Not the Congolese government, but the World Bank. And one of the things that the World Bank has also done is declared that no corporation will pay a penny of tax to the country of the Congo for 15 years while they loot the mineral wealth out of the Congo. There is a direct connection between economic exploitation and the genocidal acts that are taking place.
Brother Paul, can you repeat the last point again for our listening audience you just stated about not paying no tax in the Congo?
Yes, the World Bank. Now, understand, we're talking $24 trillion worth of minerals. That's with a T. That's $1,000 billion makes a trillion. The World Bank has declared that the companies they're giving concessions to rob the minerals out of the Congo at below the world value price, and that those same corporations do not have to pay taxes for 15 years. And it's estimated at the rate in which they're taking these minerals out of the Congo that they will totally deplete the $24 trillion worth of minerals in 15 years.
That is
right. So we need to be clear. This is about super exploitation. And the powers that be out of the United States and Europe in particular are the ones who are orchestrating, because they're the ones that control the World Bank. They're the ones that control the IMF. And they're the ones that are setting the rules where they can rob from people of African descent, from people who, I mean, we got to remember when I was young, I grew up watching TV where they had to make the Native Americans of this country look like the so-called savages. Why did they do that? Because when they gave the history lessons to us in school, they told us that the heroes of this country were the settlers in this country, and these were the very people who carried out genocidal acts against our brothers and sisters who were native to this country. They were the people who robbed the land and the resources of the native people of this country. And so they have to justify in their way of thinking to the rest of society, or it would be hard to sell the lie that the so-called heroes of the United States were heroes and not genocidal criminals who committed a genocide against a race of people. These are the same heroes who owned African slaves, who stole our labor, who robbed us, who raped our women. Yet they tell us in our history books that we're supposed to be proud of these people because they are the great forefathers of the United States. But the reality is this country was started and built on racism and on genocidal acts. And as they moved to rob the land and riches of this country, as well as they moved to rob and kidnap people of African descent to get them to work for free for them.
Okay.
We need to look at the connection here between genocide and the misrepresentation of the truth going on, not only on other parts of the world, but right here in the United States. If I may, I want to bring one other point when we start talking about genocide. If someone gets a map out and look at where oil is in West Africa, you will find that those are the exact same areas in West Africa that now has the Ebola virus. And these are the areas in West Africa in which the local fishermen were complaining to the government about their fish being messed up because of oil spillage, because of the oil companies taking oil out of the water just like they did in the Gulf of Mexico, and oil spilling into the water and killing their fish. So one has to wonder whether or not, in fact, this Ebola is biological warfare. People living along the coast of West Africa, to get them to move away from the coast, or better yet, kill the people on the coast so they don't have to worry about them complaining anymore, about them destroying their fishing. Again, I encourage people, go look up the map where oil is located in West Africa, along the coast, Atlantic coast, and then look at the same map that they have now showing you where the Ebola epidemic is located, and you'll see that they overlay over each other.
Let me weigh in real quick a reference to the question in terms of Ebola. And this is important to people understand when we talk about genocide. This notion that that Ebola is some kind of medical anomaly is not true at all. In fact, the virus was created by Walter Basun, cardiologist out of South Africa. Now, for individuals who are interested in knowing more about the creation of Ebola virus as well as other kind of viruses, they can read a book called Germs by Judith Miller, which documents, you know, the role Walter Basun played in terms of creating that virus. And the thing is, back in 1994, during the Truth and Reconciliation hearings in South Africa, Walter Basun, the cardiologist out of South Africa, had to admit his role in terms of creating those viruses. That was the only way he would be free. He had to admit that he played a part in that. It was disclosed that, in fact, not only did he create the virus, but that he was funded by the U.S. with their technology and their money. So people should understand that this stuff is not a fluke. That this stuff is created for strategic reasons, and this is the thing that people have to understand. And one thing is that you understand that this whole Ebola outbreak is relegated only to Africa, nowhere else in the world. So it's very interesting that, given the fact that many, many people travel to Africa, at this point, it's basically to Africa. So clearly this turns to the genocidal propensity among Western people is manifesting itself again in Africa, and people have to understand that.
Okay.
Well, like I said, look at the map. Look at the oil map in West Africa, and look at where the Ebola virus is spreading in West Africa, and they overlap each other.
Okay, we'd like to let our listening audience know that we also have our chat line open. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to go to our chat line and submit your questions or comments to us. Right now, we'll go to Brother Anthony Williams from the All African People Revolutionary Party, GC. We'd like to get your perspective on the subject tonight. Genocide, is it the only choice for the powerful elite? Brother Anthony, where do you weigh in on this discussion?
Okay. I concur with the points made by Brother Haki and Brother Paul earlier regarding this issue of genocide against African people. And against other people that are on land that have resources that are wanted by the capitalists, and there is definitely a pattern in terms of what we see going on in the world, and I would add that coincidentally. There were UN forces that brought a disease into Haiti, and it was ascertained that Haiti has mineral resources that are wanted by the imperialists. And a similar situation exists in Gaza, where the Palestinians are fighting against Zionist forces. So it's an international phenomena, and Africans need to see themselves in relationship to that. And one way to counter this is through getting organized, because this is a systemic problem. These are not just random incidents committed by individuals that are excessively violent or whatever. There is a pattern going on. And it seems as if where Africans cannot be exploited for their labor, they become expendable if they're on land that is desired, by the bourgeoisie and their collaborators.
Okay. We next go to our next panel, Brother. Have you advisor for the show, Brother Jabari, Welcome to Africa on the Move. What is your take on this particular topic tonight?
Greetings, brothers, and I concur with all the sentiment expressed. And I want to add another dynamic to the discussion in terms of propaganda. Being a former media studies major, I understand that in order for people to buy into this massive acts that attempt to dehumanize and seek to denigrate a group of people, you have to have a very good propaganda campaign and repeat certain images that get people to buy into. And like Brother Paul was saying earlier, one example is with the indigenous. You look at how they were showing the savages. And even with us as black people, you constantly see these images of buffoonery or criminality, or we're promiscuous, you know, we're incompetent. We have to have some type of white savior that shows us some type of guidance. And these kind of things have a lasting influence, because we even have children now that buy into it. Because I can remember as a high school student, and this was the year 2006, in my anatomy class, you had black students, junior and seniors, classifying what kind of enslaved person they would be. Now, I was thinking to myself, this is insanity, but, you know, they thought it was, comical. And as you said, that shows you that there's a disconnect between reality and what people perceive reality to be.
Okay, and last but not least, we have Brother Robert Moses. Brother Moses, you've been listening to the discussion. What would be some of the thoughts that you would like to make towards this discussion tonight?
Well, certainly it's a privilege to be on. First and foremost, when I think of genocide, I think about how the U.S. was founded on the backs and enslavement of African people and Native American people of color. Even indentured servants were used. And so slavery and oppression and the genocide of the people, including the Cherokee people, the Cherokee Nation. And today we look around and we see the U.S. government and Israel wiping out the Palestinian people. The Palestinian people, of all people, are under the gun. And certainly that is the very existence of Israel is dependent upon wiping out the population that was there before 1948. And so, you know, that's a key struggle in the UN's definition of genocide, which it would fall under.
Okay. Now, in terms of this whole discussion of genocide, when you look at, as everyone alluded to, the systematic behavior of these problems as relates to oppressed people, particularly African people, other oppressed people, as you look at the systematic historical longevity of these acts, we know in 2002 there was a creation of the International Criminal Court. And as of 2002, understanding all of these phenomena that are taking place in terms of looking at groupings of people being totally eliminated by all kind of forms of oppression, why has there never been no indictment for the International Criminal Court? Who would like to address that? Brother Haki, Brother Paul first.
Brother Africa, if I understand your question, why are people not being indicted? Simply put, interest. A lot of times, specifically when you talk about the United States, in terms of being privy to all kind of mass murders that take place around the world, to a large extent, it depends on U.S. interests. Give you an example. In Rwanda, where they had the Hutus killing the Tutsis, all right. This went on for a while. People like Madeleine Albright, people like Clinton, were well aware that the genocide was taking place against the peoples, but chose not to intervene. The question is, why they chose not to intervene? Well, they chose not to intervene simply because it doesn't serve their interest. In fact, the more the African people, you know, in Central Africa kill themselves all, the easier the level of exploitation in terms of taking the resources from that country, the easier it is to manipulate and to bribe individuals who are left after the genocide. So as far as the U.S. is concerned, getting their hands on those resources was the primary focus. And so therefore, Africans killing Africans was a plus for them. And so they refused to intervene. All kinds of excuses were justified in terms of not intervening. But clearly, the economic motive was the primary motive in terms of them not intervening. Now, almost simultaneously, if you look at what was happening in the Balkans, and you look at what was happening in Kosovo in terms of the killing of the Muslim minorities in Kosovo, then the U.S. was quick to act. The question is, why was the U.S. so quick to act when it came to Milosevic in terms of, you know, committing genocide against the Muslim minority and not intervene when it comes to the mass assassinations of the Tutsi minority? Well, in Kosovo, there were no mineral resources involved as far as the West is concerned. So the appeal was strictly one of peace. Also, it was a way in which the U.S. consolidated its power in terms of its ideological battles with Russia. And so, therefore, that reason was important for geopolitical reasons in terms of U.S. intervention. There was no resources involved, but it was politically it was important for the U.S. to intervene because they saw it as an opportunity, you know, to expand their influence in that part of the world, you know, threatening Russia. And that's why they did it. So when we talk about whether or not people intervene and we talk about all these crimes that take place, the issue is why is it that they don't intervene? It's always about interest. But keep in mind, though, when we talk about the United States, the U.S. is not a signatory to the International Criminal Court. They refuse to sign. Earlier, I talked about genocide as relates to the physicality of individuals who are being committed, who are victims of genocide. One of the things that, you know, we have to understand is that historically, when we look at the genocide as inflicted upon against the indigenous people, the so-called American Indians, those laws as related to international criminal court are not applicable. They don't apply to what happened to the Indians. But they do have relevance in terms of what's happened to African people in this society. But the thing is this. Because the immense power of the U.S. well, no government is willing to stand up, and with the exception of maybe China and Zimbabwe, and actually say that what you're doing to African people in the borders of North America is tantamount to genocide. So even though the criminal court exists, there is no means by which others can bring the United States to court because the United States intentionally didn't sign the ICC Accords, International Criminal Court Accords. And this is the problem why you have these occult happen and nothing takes place. And also, and let me just conclude, one thing we have to understand, in the context of global capitalism, what it does, it creates a struggle between the few who have and the many who don't have. Inevitably, you get a large number of people in which you don't have any need for. The question is, what do you do with these large number of people you don't have a need for? Now, in terms of the history of this country, you always find some kind of creative in terms of getting rid of them. In the United States, you have a high incarceration rate of African men. It is a very, very slow process. It's a process of attrition. So it's not quite effective as just killing off large number of people at a time. But the pressure is growing on the system in terms of doing something to these only people that you don't have a need for. And so to come back at Brother Jabari's concern in terms of how the media portrays African people, it's very, very important that the media continue to portray us as some type of archetype, that we're not, that someone not human, not intelligent society. Because those in power, not even in government, but those rich capitalists, those individuals who run the society, because keep in mind, This we're talking about, this is fascism. This is fascism that we're living in. Corporations run this country. Make no mistake about that. But those rich individuals are in a position to manipulate the mindset of other people in society who begin to see African people as expandable. And so the desire or the will to just kill off large number of African people is something that we ought to understand that is certainly almost a reality in terms of understanding global capitalism. So this is the real danger African people confronting society.
Brother Paul, you come in, speak to this question of slack indictment and why nothing hasn't taken place and how do we respond to it? I'm still there, Brother Paul. Okay, let's we come back to Brother Paul. We'll go to Brother Anthony. Brother Anthony, what is your take when we look at this so-called international court? When we look at just the basic definition that came out of the United Nations expressing what makes genocide, it seems clearly to anyone who have any inkling of the historical oppression the African people have faced and other oppressed people have faced, there is a genocidal process that is taking place. How do we address this question of bringing forth the criminals who are really perpetuating and behind this whole process of killing large sums of groups and people off just for their own individual self-gain?
Well, one way we bring an end to it is we have to do a better job of educating ourselves and other people about our reality. And it's interesting that since the International Criminal Court has been created, only non-European political officials have been brought before it. No one out of Europe or the U.S. has ever been brought before this court. And so it seems to be another setup to further oppress African people and others and other struggling people around the world. And this is a concern, is the fact that a lot of us buy into it, but that's due to the manipulation by the media and the educational system that most Africans in the diaspora are subject to. So I think education becomes a critical piece, along with political organization of our people. And the only way we stop these attempts at genocide is through the political unification of Africa. We must become united and organized as a people in order to stop the systemic genocide that's being perpetrated against us.
And before we go to our station break, I'll let Brother Jabari get in to give us his analysis on this question of who are the real criminals, why they haven't been held accountable. How do we address that question, Brother Jabari, from your perspective?
Well, I feel that it's on the basis in terms of who influences this decision, and as has been stated time and time again tonight, in terms of when you look at the money trail, because it's amazing how much money can buy influence, and look at some of the key nations that may have been involved in forming this court, maybe a matter of it's not financially viable if you go after certain people that will be able to help finance the operation of it.
Okay, to our listening audience, you are listening to Africa on the Move. As your host, Brother Africa, we are discussing the issue of genocide and the question in particular. Genocide is the only choice for the powerful and the elite. We'd like to know what is your views and perspective. Back call in at 323-679-0841, or if you are online listening to this program, we have a chat line open. So when we come back, we'd like to have this dialogue open to our audience, and we'll be right back. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be right back. So stay tuned.
Africa, the center of the world. Latitude zero, longitude zero. Planned by the Creator. The Xanthropus was the first man found on the earth. That earth was the motherland, Africa. We know that without total understanding of what happened in the past, it would be difficult to relate to the future. We know that within the structure of the music, there should be a message, and the message should be truth. So now, we give you Africa, the center of the world.
Africa.
That's right. Africa is the center of the world. A lot of times the word center is another word for nucleus, where all things evolve around. We understand that this issue of when we look at Africa, there's an old saying that he who controls Africa controls the world. Being a student of history, and one of the books I read years ago that had an influence, impact on my life in terms of joining the movement was the book The World and Africa by W.E.B. Du Bois. He stated that, he was talking about how Africa has always been the nucleus, the center of the world, where it dictates and influences everything from how Europe became developed to the various slave trades and institutions that came involved. And just to understand, just have the understanding of how things work in relationship to Africa of its resources and its labor. And still today, the same phenomena is going on. So one of the things we've been doing today, we've been talking about genocide, and we want to ask the question, is genocide the only choice for the elite and the powerful? One of the things we'd like to do at this point in time is we talk about genocide. Maybe go around the world and talk about different places where genocide has manifested itself. And also the question of the forms of genocide. Do it only have to be physical? What other forms and methods of genocide take place? So right now, I'm going to go right back. I was trying to reach Brother Paul earlier from Friends of the Congo, and I'd like to just raise this with Brother Paul. Can you talk about some of the areas the genocide has taken place and is taking place as it comes to Africa, Brother Paul, and what forms of it?
Well, we can start off with the original big genocide, and that was the slave trade that took place when they slaughtered so many African people as they were stealing them to bring them to Europe as well as to the United States and South America. So that's really one of the first big example of genocide. And again, it had a for-profit motive behind why there was that act was going on. Then you look at what's going on in genocide. When you look at the perspectives on Africa, you can see what happened during the regime of apartheid and Ian Smith in Zimbabwe and the Portuguese in Angola, Guinea-Bissau, the Cape Verdes in Mozambique. Well, other examples here in the 20th century in which genocidal acts were done against people. And the United States and Europe was very much actively involved in supplying weaponry to the Portuguese, to the South African regime, and also very clearly Israel played a big role in aiding and abetting Ian Smith and the apartheid regime of South Africa in carrying out its brutal attempt of super exploitation, the country of South Africa, Zimbabwe, and Namibia. So when we look at these type of things and then looking at what's going on right now in the Congo and what went on in Rwanda, as the brother spoke of earlier, the United States clearly understood the role of what was happening inside of Rwanda. In fact, they helped orchestrate what happened in Rwanda. We need to be very clear that when Bill Clinton claimed he did not know what was going on, anybody who's done homework knows that the President of the United States is briefed every morning as to what has happened in the world the day before. And to think that 200 people were killed and the President not be briefed on it, that there was 200 people being killed through some political act, is ludicrous to believe that. And how then do you have hundreds of thousands of people being killed in Rwanda and Bill Clinton claiming he knew nothing about what was going on in Rwanda? Another good example was when Paul Kagame, the traitor in which Bill Clinton and the United States supported in the Rwandan war, decided that he was going to come in and carry out war against the people of the Congo
He did that tremendously with the U.S. help. I would like to encourage the listeners to go to the documentary, Defense of the Congo, help put together. And it's at website www.congojustice.org. And you will see that even people who work for the State Department said they could not understand why our government was arming Paul Kagame to the teeth when he openly said that he was going to invade the Congo, which meant there would be massive numbers of people losing their lives in that invasion. And he did it on the pretext that he wanted to protect the border of his country. Well, we need to look at a map to understand that Rwanda is only 1/90th the size of the Congo. So if his interest was the border of the Congo, why did he go over 1,500 kilometers to Kinshasa if his concern were to go after the Hutus who had made camp in the Congo on the Congo side of the border? So it is very, very clear that these misinformational campaigns orchestrated by U.S. corporations and U.S. government with the help of the U.S. media to misrepresent the kind of criminal acts, the genocidal acts, that the U.S. government using our tax dollars has been spending. And here we're right now getting ready to go through another example of genocidal acts. The latest thing in the news now, we talk about ISIS. This group over there in Iraq and Syria, and the United States acting like they don't know anything about this group. What do they do? But this is the group that the United States government used our tax dollars to train in Libya to overthrow the government of Muammar Gaddafi. They supplied them with weapons, and you had criminals like the senator from Arizona, John McCain, who proudly insisted on the United States arming not only ISIS when they were in Libya, but arming them when they were in Syria. In fact, there were pictures of John McCain standing next to leaders of ISIS as he was demanding that the U.S. government spend our tax dollars and give them more weapons. Yet the media has given him a pass and act as if it didn't happen. But the facts are clear. It did happen. And you have a president that has gone along with the game plan and never chose to expose the role of his predecessor or these other politicians who are pushing this campaign, are pushing again an effort that can be easily described as genocidal acts being done against people. And these things are all being led by the greed of certain multinational corporations and the power they have over the politicians that they finance to get into office and to carry out their wishes as they go around the world robbing people for their natural resources, robbing governments for their natural resources. And the question is, when will we here in the United States wake up and understand these criminal acts do not serve our interests at all? Thank you.
Paul, that's a million-dollar question, and one reason why Africa on the Move came to existence is to try to create the climate where we can answer that question. When will our people wake up on a mass scale? What must be done? And right now we have a listening audience, participant. We're going to go to right now. We'd like to get audience feedback on the question of genocide is the only choice of the powerful and elite, and just this whole issue of genocide. What you think about it as it relates to this massive killing of oppressed people around the world? Caller 94135, what's your thoughts on this topic tonight? Caller 94135, welcome to Africa on the Moon. Caller 9434-9435, your question or comment? Okay, I guess we'll come back to the caller. I thought he had something he wanted to say. Let's go to Brother Robert, one of the things we alluded to earlier was the question of, we were talking about different places and different examples of genocide. For your understanding, what are some of the areas outside of Africa where you may can say that this is also a phenomenon that has taken place or is taking place right now where the people need to be concerned?
Yeah, I think the brothers have described the situation, different struggles in Africa which have come up, and certainly, you know, you don't want to belittle them. I think in terms of the international world community and the focus of tension right now between, well, a critical moment right now is the situation in Missouri. Certainly, Palestine and Missouri are connected in the struggle, and Palestinian people recognize the situation in Ferguson, and the people in Ferguson recognize the situation in Palestine. And I think these are at this moment in time, these, the attention of the world is on these areas.
Okay. Brother Haki, how do we connect these connections? What other examples of genocide in other areas maybe you'd like to share with the audience, particularly as it relates to not so much physical but other means, medical, speaking, chemical, biological? So share with the people in terms of what is your understanding of other areas and other methods of how genocide may manifest itself.
I think one of the precursors to genocide has a lot to do with race. We've been talking a lot about economics thus far. We have to talk at some point on the role of race in terms of genocide. Wherever you look at cases of genocide, whether it be in Africa, Central America, South America, the Middle East, it's always inflicted upon people of color. With respect to Africa, there's a particular disdain in terms of the people. One of the things is that when you look at the genocide in Rwanda, when you look at the genocide committed against the Herero people in Namibia, one thing that's always been very consistent, that is that African people are not perceived as human beings. And so therefore their lives are not perceived as important. This philosophy manifests itself in terms of U.S. foreign policy. But not only foreign policy, we have to understand even in the context right in the borders inside of North America, we have to understand that the same perception in terms of African people prevails. In other words, the notion that in fact that we're something less than human is pretty much the thinking of the people in power. And so therefore our rights, our human rights, our right to exist are not taken seriously because we're perceived as something less than a human being. This has real implications in terms of when you talk about an economy that deteriorates. For instance, you have a situation now in this country where the economy is 70% of the economy. 70%. I mean, when you look at the economy, 70% of the GDP of the overall economy is consumer spending. That means that in order for this economy to expand, in order for it to create jobs, in order to create wealth, people have to have money to invest in the economy. What's happening is that money is being taken away from people when you have large-scale unemployment, particularly with the African people. We have people whose wages continue to decline, particularly African people. Then clearly, people's ability to contribute to the economy is undermined. Now, in a global capitalist society, if you don't have money to contribute, then what good are you? And this is the problem. This is a very peculiar problem that the African people in America have to begin to address. As far as the ruling class is concerned, our existence is esoteric. We have no right to exist. And so for them, the question in terms of just how do you eliminate these African people, all these people you don't need, is not only a question that's peculiar to international politics, but also peculiar to national politics. And I think this is the thing that we have to understand as African people. Also, I think that one of the things we start talking about genocide, at the very basic, it seems to me that medical care is very fundamental in terms of human necessity. When you deny a people, at the very basic, medical care, what are you saying in terms of their right to exist? As we understand in America, which is an employee-based medical establishment, if you don't have work, then you don't have access to medical care. Now, Affordable Care Act is all in good theoretically, but the bottom line is all you're transferring wealth from poor folks to corporations. In terms of quality care, never really gets addressed in terms of affordable care. It sounds good on paper, but in all practicality, it does nothing in terms of really addressing the need and the quality health care for people, African and or poor people in society. So the question in terms of just how much of a right do you have to exist? You look at societies whose GDP is not as high as the United States. For example, Cuba. Cuba doesn't have a high GDP per citizen. But when you look at it in terms of its medical expenditures, when you look at it in terms of emphasis on making sure that people have the best health care, Cuba is among the best in the world. Now, how do you square the fact that you got this little country which is struggling, who is able to take care of its people in terms of providing medical health care for their people, then the so-called most powerful nation in the world doesn't have the ability to provide health care for its citizens? It's very clear. The implication you should draw is that the implication is African people not have a right to exist. If you don't have a right to exist, the question becomes, how do you eradicate, how do you eliminate, how do you get rid of those people you don't want? Certainly lack of health care contributes to getting rid of people that you don't want. Certainly people don't have access to food eliminates people's longevity here on the earth. Certainly, people who don't have access to education limits their options, so it limits their right to be on this earth. So we're seeing there's a war of attrition being enacted against African people, slowly but surely killing off African people. But as I alluded to earlier, whether or not this process of attrition is fast enough, given the speed at which society is deteriorating, remains a question. I speculate that given the fact that the economy is in such disarray, that the desire in terms of actually eliminating large number of people at a time is viable as far as the capitalist is concerned. So when you talk about the National Defense Authorization Act, when you talk about incarcerating large number of people, then clearly what you're saying is that these people don't have a right to exist. If African people in society don't wake up and smell the coffee, one day they'll wake up and realize when it's too late that this is reality. We need organization. We need ideological clarity. We need that. We need a frame of reference. We need to understand quite precisely what this genocidal process means to African people, not only in the world, but in America as well. Some of us believe that the problem of genocide is a problem for the Africans. No, it's not a problem for the Africans. It's a problem for the Africans in America as well. So we had to understand that precisely. So all the implications, so we talk about policy, the policy is very, very clear that African people, because they're not human, we're not perceived as human, have no right to exist. And as far as the capitalist society is concerned, eradication, get rid of these people, is the only solution in terms of longevity for the system. We have to understand that, and that's very, very clear.
Okay, to the listening audience, we're letting you know that we have a chat line open. Feel free to go to our chat line for those who are online and submit any views or comments that you'd like to make on the subject tonight. This is a timely subject, and it's something in terms of if you don't diagnose the right hypothesis or try to solve what the problem is, it become very difficult to come up with a correct solution. In fact, I just made a statement. I'd like to address this question to Anthony. Brother Anthony, in terms of looking at the political party that you represent, our African People Revolutionary Party, GC, and when we look at this question of this phenomenon that is taking place, of this genocidal process that is afflicting African people globally, and understanding the nature of the capitalist system, the imperialist system, how do you go about framing it in the correct way where people will come to view the seriousness of this process that is taking place among our people? How do you get our people to view this versus looking at it as maybe individual cases that aren't affecting them in that region?
Well, I think it's important to have develop a global perspective if you don't already have one. I want to touch on some of the other ways that genocide manifests itself among our people, and it doesn't always have to take a directly violent form. It can also take a cultural form, as have been practiced against the American Indians. Another form that we have to be aware of is taking youth away from the people that they came from and giving them and bringing them up in a totally different culture, and that has been done, particularly to the American Indians, in which the children of the deceased parents were not allowed to remain inside their own community, but they were adopted by Europeans. That same phenomenon happened to the so-called Aborigines. It is occurring to the Aborigines in Australia. Another society of African descent. And also another thing is, the birth control movement for sterilizations, and so we have to be keenly aware of all the ways in which these genocidal attacks against our people manifest themselves. Police brutality is a big aspect of it. But it's only one part of it, and we do have to be keenly aware of that, and also the role that our educational system and media plays in perpetuating the ideas that we're subhuman. That is an ideological problem and requires an ideological solution. And that we must get organized politically to address that. And we need a revolutionary ideology to guide our struggle.
Okay, in terms of, and I just going to open this is open to the panel. Maybe I can get Jabari and Robert response first, and then we open to the others. And for our listening audience, feel free to call in at 323-679-0841. Please hit 1 if you have any views or comments, and we would acknowledge you by your last 4 number. And again, our chat line is open. We welcome all questions. This is my question. In terms of being able to physically view some of the atrocities that are taking place in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, what lessons are we supposed to be learning from this particular brutality? Brothers Jabari and Moses, and then the rest can come in.
Well, one thing we can learn is that white supremacy knows no bounds, because if you notice the words white supremacy, that automatically indicates a state of being where all of those of European descent and have a Eurocentric mind state trying to create a permanent establishment where they're always in control. So that's something that clearly what we're dealing with here, because you notice that's the cases with Sister Cynthia McKinney, others reported when they just were trying to deliver resources to Gaza, you noticed that their ships were ramshackling, treated like, they were some type of army coming in, you know, basically with active warfare against them, you know, their ships being ransacked and the people being intimidated and some ships attempting to be knocked out of the water, you know. It was a very aggressive atmosphere for those people that are trying to bring attention to what's going on over there. It just reminds me of something that's very interesting about how the U.S. Law enforcement is set up. You know, there's a saying that they say that possession is 9/10 of the law. So just like what goes on in Gaza, if you have that phrase possession is 9/10 of the law, that means those who are enforcing the law are only protecting the elite. Those who are not part of the elite get what they get.
Brother Robert, what lessons are we supposed to be learning from what we're seeing in the Gaza Strip and West Bank? From your perspective,
I think if we don't know it, we should know it by now. That apartheid is fascism. That Zionism is racism and fascism, basically. And that, you know, the viciousness by which the children and the population, the leadership of the resistance, any kind of opposition is being just slaughtered and killed. And it just shows, you know, that this is an irreconcilable contradiction. It's an antagonistic contradiction, make no doubt about it, and that it's irreconcilable that this government can continue to plague these people like that.
Okay. Brother Haki, Brother Paul, glad you have a perspective from the same question. What lessons are we supposed to be learning from this ongoing slaughter of the brothers and sisters in the West Bank and Gaza Strip?
I think one of the things we need to look at, I've had the opportunity to actually be in the Gaza Strip as well as the West Bank, and I can tell you that there is a consistent violation of human rights, especially as it pertains to water. This is an area of the world that's a semi-desert. And after the war in 1967, the Israeli army took control over all of the wells in the occupied territory. And to date, what they're doing is in the summertime, when there's very little rainfall, they cut the water off to the Palestinians. And they let the water flow freely to the illegal settlements that are built on Palestinian territory. And so, I mean, if one can't see that as a clear violation of human rights, where you come onto someone else's land and you steal the water in a semi-desert situation, then in fact, and this is something the United States clearly knows to be true. This is not something that's a secret. Anybody that goes over there knows this to be true. I had the opportunity one time, I was in Hebron, and I visited a hospital and ended up having to wash my hands. So I go wash my hands, and there's no water to wash your hands. And what the Palestinians are forced to do is then turn around and buy water from Israel just to survive. I mean, these type of clear violations of human rights that the United States clearly knows about, knows that there's several articles in the human rights law, international rights of human rights, that the Israelis consistently violate. And then to have the Congress of this country and the so-called black leadership in Congress both to say that they support Israel 100% is a crime against humanity in itself. And we have to begin to hold this country accountable for the kind of war crimes that it participates in and giving these weapons to Israel. Now, why would they do this? There's an economic basis for why Israel is allowed to do what it's doing. And one of the biggest things is that most people know that the source of oil, a major source of oil in the world, is in the Middle East. And Israel has been the extended arm of U.S. and European military in the Middle East, one that can always be there to threaten different Arab countries if they decide they want to boycott Europe or the United States for oil. And so the United States, again, back to this issue of greed, back to this issue
of Economics has a policy that is inhumane, unjust, and in fact should be taken to war crimes itself. The only reason why the United States probably have not been taken before war crimes in the international court is because they refused to sign the treaty. But yet the United States are the ones who could round up Charles Taylor and saw that he went there, and Milosevic and saw that he went there. And when it was clear that Milosevic looked like he was going to win his trial, they then induced a heart attack. And the man dies in jail. So he couldn't come out and really give the details as to what was behind, what was going on over there in Yugoslavia. And one other point that needs to be made clear. Bin Laden was given an honorary citizenship to Bosnia because he had trained many of the so-called Liberation Army of Bosnians to fight against Yugoslavia. So one has to ask, why was the United States aligning themselves with these terrorists in Yugoslavia? And the answer is quite clear. Back to economics. When you look at the Caspian Sea, there's a huge deposit of natural gas and oil. And the United States wanted to run a pipeline through the southern part of Yugoslavia to get that gas and oil over to Western Europe so that they would no longer be dependent upon Russian oil and natural gas. And when they asked the government in Yugoslavia, they said that they would not be able to control that valve, that Yugoslavia would keep its territorial rights to control what happened with that pipeline. And that's what led to that war inside of Yugoslavia. And if you look at the map, and I encourage people to look at maps, you will see that the three areas of Yugoslavia that the United States participated in that war on the side of were the three areas in which that pipeline is presently being built, running from the Caspian Sea over to Western Europe. And so there's a direct connection to economic connection to how the United States participates in genocidal acts. And we need to just pay attention to the maps and look and see what role the U.S. is playing.
When you talk about genocidal acts, clearly I think we need to talk a little bit about blockades, how they have historically used blockades to try to overthrow, undermine, and destroy groups of people, i.e., in this case, we're looking at Cuba, we're looking at Zimbabwe, there has been other countries where they use the blockade as a form of a genocide act, and some people address that aspects of blockade used as a tool of a form of genocide.
I was just going to make one quick comment on that. And that is no question that that blockade has been used as a genocidal act against the people of Cuba. But for people who kept up with what's going on in Africa, it is no question that it was the people of Cuba that prevented a genocidal act from happening in Angola. And in them carrying out their struggle in support of the people of Angola, they end up supporting the people of South Africa and Namibia and Zimbabwe, because they totally demoralized the South African military when they showed that the Africans from Cuba were able to beat them as pilots as well as fighters on the ground.
Exactly. And to add to that one point, Paul, then we'll go to Brother Haki, let him speak on this issue also, was that when you look at two of the wars that the Cubans openly participated in terms of when there was a confrontation between the West, one was that war dealing with in Angola, and we know that they won that one. And another one was, when you look at the BLP, in terms of proxy war, they beat them both at the BLP inside of Cuba and in the southern part of Africa through Angola. So Cuba has an excellent track record. Stand up for humanity and fighting for what's in the best interest of the people. Brother Haki, in terms of this whole blockade, using the blockade as an act, as a genocide act, what is your contribution to that subject?
Yeah, well, clearly in reference to the United Declaration of Human Rights, I mean, it's a crime to actually do that because of the amount of harm that you're inflicted on the masses of people inside those countries that you alluded to. One of the things I just want to briefly talk about Africa is that one of the things when we start talking about genocide, often distinctions are made. For instance, this perception that in fact that you can commit atrocity against individuals of that group without necessarily indicting or potentially wanting to commit crimes against the total group, which is kind of logic and which I'm hard pressed to even understand. But one of the things that bothers me to no end, that was a African-American woman, Eunice Carter, for the National Council of Negro Women, who made the statement that her position was that the Negro problem, in a Negro problem, the intent is to preserve the group on a different level of existence, but not to destroy it. Now, it seems to me either the genocidal process exists or it doesn't exist. It seems to me that she's conveniently explaining away the genocidal process as it relates to African people in the society or African people throughout the world. And particularly, it bothers me because if you go by her understanding in terms of genocide, then what happened in Ferguson, Missouri, is just an isolated incident in which it has no economic precedent. And so, therefore, you can't tie it to all those policies, to the history that preceded the event. To me, that makes no sense at all. In terms of understanding the whole genocidal process, it's important that you understand the history. So when we talk about blockades in terms of U.S. government committing blockades, one of the things that are very clear, these blockades does nothing in terms of enhancing the economic interest. On the contrary, it undermines economic interest. So we can dispense with the notion that, in fact, that they are motivated by economics in these particular circumstances. There are other things motivating them. In this particular situation, it's all about control. And I think for a lot in the Western world who have this perception that, in fact, they got a right to control people of color, that's just their inherent right, I think it's a very, very strong motivating factor in terms of a lot of these crimes of genocide being committed against people of color by actually, you know, having blockades imposed on their countries. So clearly it's very, very illegal, and, you know, I think it's something we might be concerned about, and that's my view on that.
Okay, let's move forward. Let's talk a little bit about the question to expose something is to kill it. There's a saying said to expose something to kill it. Well, all of these atrocities that are taking place around the world, and we look at the media. Where's the African media? Where's the so-called African and black media in terms of telling their story from our perspective? What is the major problem why they cannot do this or not doing this? Brother Jabari, I'd like for you to take a lead off with this one. And then Brother Anthony and Brother Robert.
Well, in regards to the media, we have to have a fundamental understanding in regards to most of the major media who is in control of it, and it happened to be those of Jewish descent. And we know where they stand politically, ideologically, and socially in regards to how they view black people. They're mad making mass amounts of billions of dollars at the expense by utilizing them in the pictures, in the movies, and from an acting point of view, but in terms of them actually making the decision as producer and directing those positions of authority, they're not trying to have that. Because they know that means you will have situations like when you look at what Oscar Micheaux did in the 20s, where he's able to create films that were critiques and sharp satires of the black existence. And one thing that I find very interesting is that in regards to Spike Lee, you know, he said a number of movies that were in theaters, but one of his most poignant movies, Bamboozle, you know, it's very rare you will even see it on television, and that movie was a good critique, and I recommend it for all of you all, a good critique of the plight of what it is to deal with in regards to black media.
Brother Robert, we keep seeing the eyes at will through the media, the European media. Where is the African media, and why they refuse to address and talk about these major issues as it relates to the interests of African people and African communities?
Well, I know the corporate media, you know, it always puts its bin on everything. I think most of the media, in some shape or form, is talking about the situation, especially in Ferguson, Missouri. I think, you know, it's just too big to ignore at this point. And so there's going to be some kind of lip service given to it. The question is, what kind of ideological and you know, political position is it going to be expressing? And I don't know. I've noticed in the D.C. area there's some free media on the Informer. It's been covering it. I need to investigate this a little more before I start talking about it.
Brother Anthony, what's your take on the so-called African press and their lack of accountability in addressing these issues and being in the forefront of framing it properly so that people can understand what's really
on the connection? The reason for that, Brother Africa, is I take it if you look at who's in control of the African media, is largely the African bourgeoisie, petty bourgeoisie, which is controlled by the larger European bourgeoisie. So therefore, they control even the African media, you know, inside our communities. The bourgeoisie, as a class, has a certain similar perspective in terms of the control and domination of African people, and so we cannot rely upon the even the African media, as a primary source of information, because they're under control by the same bourgeoisie that controls the mainstream media. In terms of lessons that we can draw from what's happening in Ferguson, not only in Ferguson but around the world, is that Africans have got to start connecting the dots. We cannot continue to view these acts of violence against us as isolated incidents. There is a pattern, and if you understand it, and the key is understanding the history, as Brother Paul pointed out, the history of these areas where these incidents have taken place, and there are certain common patterns that start to emerge when you start to analyze that. So we've got to look at things as a whole and start to intensify our level of organization and political education.
Well, let me just weigh in real quickly, if I can, Brother Africa. This question in terms of the unwillingness of the African press to engage vital issues in community. One thing that we neglected to say, I think we have to be very candid when we talk about this phenomenon. I think we have to look at the issue in terms of just outright ignorance, unbridled ignorance. A lot of the petty bourgeois element, have internalized, the worst in terms of what it would be an African person. In fact, this notion that things define who they are in terms of money, they have internalized that. And so therefore, their thing in terms of just being able to actualize is all about, one, acceptance by the broadest culture, and also by the opportunity to make money. And so therefore, in their minds, any issue particular that pertains to African concerns, for them it's not a concern, because their interest is the interest of the dominant society. And so we have to understand that. And so to a large extent, we have to recognize the level of ignorance, excuse me, the level of ignorance that's pertinent, that's persistent when we talk about the petty bourgeois element in the African community. So that's my problem. The question is, How, in the midst of that, how do we enlighten the most resistant, element in the community? That is a question that we have to begin to take up. Because unless we can find a way to impact on these individuals who have their hands in the liver, on the lever, to some extent, then those issues that are pertinent, are vital to our people understanding, they won't touch.
Brother Haki, you're interested in terms of your last analysis, because I'd like to go that way right now with our listening audience. I'd like you to maybe talk a little bit about two issues. How much are we responsible, those who are in position of authority, those who are in position of access to information, those who us who are in position of benefiting and getting the resources from these genocidal behaviors, how much of it do we bear responsible for? As those, particularly as those Africans living in these Western countries that's benefiting directly and indirectly from the wealth from these genocide policies, but not contributing or doing nothing to try to alleviate it. How much blame do we share? Brother Paul, I'll let you start off with that one.
Mm-hmm.
Brother Paul, are you with us? I think you maybe have some problems with this. With his phone, let's just go with, okay, Brother Anthony, start with you.
How much blame do we
place on ourselves in terms of those who have access to information, those who have benefit resources, those who know what's going on but choose not to act? How much of this do we blame? How much blame lies with African people who are in those capacities?
I think this has to be tied in with the class interest that exists inside the African community, and it is not uniform. There are some, there are some Africans who recognize the corruption, dishonesty, and viciousness of the system, but choose to align with it for their own selfish interests. And there are those who choose, who understand it, and choose to cast a lot with the masses of suffering working African people. Let's see, it's our fault in general, but it's also due to the fact that We do not fully understand that we're engaged in a nation class struggle, which means that we're oppressed as a nation and as a class. Now there are some Africans that benefit from our suffering, unfortunately, and to pursue their selfish interests, they choose to align with the capitalist bourgeoisie. We have to fight against those forces as well as organize the African working class to bring about their liberation in conjunction with the other struggling oppressed people around the world, such as the Palestinians, American Indians, et cetera.
So, Bobby, what is your take on it?
Repeat the question, please.
How much blame should we have in terms of our participation in this process of these processes of genocidal acts and behavior, where we benefit, where we have access to this information and knows it, but fail to share it with the masses of the people? I mean, how much responsibility go to the African community or those in positions
My point of view is that we have to hold those brothers and sisters who have resources to actively address it accountable, because one thing that sickens me, and you can find this information on the Internet, is that the Congressional Black Caucus is brief on a number of the issues, but because they're being sponsored by certain media companies, certain major corporations, you know, it's amazing when it comes time to vote in Congress, you know, they go along with the elite and they carry out the agenda. They don't think twice about it, you know. So that's one of the reasons why Cynthia McKinney, when she was a congresswoman, she's constantly at odds with those other people that look like her but didn't necessarily serve the interests of the people. But then again, what do you expect from career politicians who have made a number of compromises contrary to the people that look like them?
Brother Robin, your take.
Yes, we have to hold people accountable for their actions. You reap what you sow, and you know, but sooner or later we have to know who did what and why. And we start at the top with Obama and his signature drone killings, and we have to remember these people and remember what they've done. Because, you know, there is going to be a revolution and there is going to be a judgment.
Okay, to our listening audience, again, we are dealing with the whole concept of genocide. We ask the question, genocide is the only option for the rich and the powerful and the elite. And we are talking about this particular phenomenon because it's definitely having an impact on African people and oppressed people throughout the world. The question becomes, one, how do we frame it in a way where our people come to understand this phenomenon? And two, how do we recognize it and who is responsible for it? Who benefits from it? And how should they be punished for these acts? So feel free, we have a few minutes left to call in at 323-679-0841. If you'd like to make a comment, make sure you hit 1. And so, therefore, we want to acknowledge the last 4 numbers of your phone number. So we will continue discussion. I'm going to try to come back to Brother Paul and then Haki, and I like to phrase the issue of everybody talking about crime, telling me we are the criminals. In terms of we talk about this question of genocide, how people financially, economically benefit from it. Can we talk or can you give some kind of background assessment on who are some of the major players, companies and individuals who benefit from these kind of policies and behavior? Brother Paul, can you speak to that a little bit? I think we still lost Paul. Brother Haki, can you speak to that in some capacity? How do we view this question as who benefit, who are some of the players to benefit from this?
Raise the question, who are the real criminals? I mean, clearly the real criminals are the capitalist class. I mean, who are the real quintessential criminals? When we talk about theft, when we talk about stealing, when we talk about taking, killing, robbing, murdering, all those variables are applicable to corporations in particular the ruling class in terms of, you know, their desire to obtain wealth. So unfortunately, they're in a position because they control the medias to in fact call the victim, you know, define the victim as criminals. In fact, when you talk about the criminal acts, it's very, very clear who the criminals are. One of the things the Chinese talk about, they talk about government. There's an old Chinese proverb that says, governments create crimes, but the criminal carries it out. In other words, the Chinese government is well aware that the kind of policy they adopt, to a large extent, is going to impact on the quality of life for the mass of people, which defines the level of crime that's going to exist in society. In a capitalist society, because it's all about money, the rights or the needs of human beings is not important. And so, therefore, they're certainly willing to have a tremendous amount of crime as long as they have apparatuses in place, prisons, police, that in fact brutalize and incarcerate large number of people. So we understand that when we start talking about the crime in terms of the catalyst for crime, then we understand it's the corporate America. Now, one of the things that's very interesting, recently I read an article in which they talked about the Bank of America, in which they they were fined $17 billion for the so-called subprime debacle back 7-8 years ago. They were fined $17 billion, but, of course, the U.S. government cut that to $12 billion, which made them responsible for actually repaying $5 billion. as a fine. But of course, with all the accounting and the other kinds of discounts afforded to corporations, they won't end up paying anything. So they won't be punished for the crimes in terms of using poor people to make money by having them take out loans in which, you know, they know that because of the way those bonds were structured, they understood that those bonds would increase yearly, I mean, on a monthly basis, which means it simply would outgrow people's ability to actually pay their mortgage. They knew that, but they didn't care because it was all about making money. So this is the problem in terms when we talk about criminality. So we understand clearly who the real criminals are. In terms of the general recital process, and we've been alluding tonight to the fact that, you know, they stand to make a lot of money, and that's no question about it. By the same token, they're willing to destroy millions, tens and tens of millions of, maybe hundreds of millions of people on a yearly basis, and they don't care. And so it's incumbent upon the masses of people, you know, if in fact they're fair, honest, God-fearing, if you will, to stand up and actually, you know, hold account these corporations by standing up and actually enlighten themselves and begin to deal with some of these issues that adversely impacts on humanity. So to answer your question in terms of who the real criminal, there's no question about that, who the real criminals are. They're corporate America. They're Koch brothers. When it immediately comes to mind in terms of some of the biggest criminals on the planet, in terms of their ability to control a whole hostage entire political system, in terms of creating a situation which not only where people don't have opportunity for jobs or opportunity to eat or opportunity for shelter, but to create an opportunity where those same individuals who are victimized on the most grossest kind of level are re-victimized, you know, by systems that you're not even human and not even deserving of certain things. So to answer your question, when we talk about who the real criminals are, I think most people at this point are beginning to realize the real criminals are the corporate America and the henchmen, the capitalist class.
And when you talk about corporate America, we don't separate them from the Republican Democratic Party as their ringleader. Would we agree with that assessment?
Oh, absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely. I mean, for anybody in the 21st century who thinks there's a qualitative difference between Republicans and Democrats, they've not got a bridge to sail. Clearly, the Republicans and Democrats, Malcolm alluded to back in the 60s, are two sides of the same coin, and that's very, very clear. They both serve the interests of the ruling class. They don't give a... It's not about serving the interests of the constituents. It's not about giving a damn about their constituents. It's about who can put money in my pocket, pure and simple. And to that extent, the politicians, and I think most Americans would agree, constitute a criminal class because they're complicit in the crimes that are taking place in the society, and so they, too, are part of the criminal class.
It is unfortunate. We still have a lot of our people. They are putting their life in the hands of the Democrat and Republican Party to guide them and direct them, and I don't know what it's going to take for history to show them that they are not your friends. But let's move forward. We only have a few minutes left. We do have a listening audience, one of our listening audience, person for our audience. They have called in, and we're going to ask them to get their views of conduct on the subject tonight of genocide. And our question is, genocide is the only choice for the most powerful and elite. We'd like to have your views and comment. Call on 4381. 4381, welcome to Africa on your move.
Thank you. Well, two things I want to say is that I certainly agree with Hakeem on everything he said. It is, of course, the corporate capitalist, and everyone has known that, and we still continue to know that. The other piece is that it's covered all their bases. The other piece that I'm thinking about goes into social service agencies, the whole system the government set in and set up within that foster care system. And so there's system after system. And then there's another system in the religious community, Catholicism included, where all of these different atrocities take place and these criminals are allowed to promulgate and ruin lives on a social service level, on a social level, and that too is another form of genocide for people of color, usually African descent. They start on us first and they continue to the next one. And what they remind me of, if you see these movies where, you know, there are people that say, ah, this evil, powerful, wealthy person, I'm going to rule the world, and I'll do anything to do it. And it's like, what do you want to do, rule the world, the evil emperor? It's that sort of thing. And I heard someone on a show earlier today, and they were talking about the Voting Rights Act and what the responsibility has been and should be within the community and what should be done and why it's like it is. And so in the conference that they're having now, the agenda should have been a voting rights bill or agenda, because that's where a lot of the problems are going to be. And if you look at it statistic-wise and with all of the people in the South, there are more now, more and more and more people. Even some have gone and come back. And so there you could really elect and get something done, but we're not doing that. And that's one piece. And then finally, I want to say this. I think we play a role in our own genocide as a people from the simple standpoint of the unity piece, lack of unity. And so how can we be united? What can we do? Why can't we just do a sanction? You know, economically, we know that we're the best consumers around, from not just wealthy blacks, middle-class blacks, middle-income, poor, super poor. Why can't we participate in some sanctions? Why are we still groveling over what they're doing to us? And I think we participate by buying in the economy, because what we could do, and I know it's a stretch, is to do something like buy your food, buy your gas to get to work, and just kind of shut it down a little bit. And I think we can participate in our own genocide, and I think we have to take responsibility for that too, myself included.
Sister, your issues are well pointed. I would like for each one of our audience to maybe take a general quick response to that. Starting with Brother Anthony.
I think we do, and I think it's because we're not sufficiently organized, and that we don't control our own land, which is Africa, that we're forced to participate in our own oppression. And I pointed out to a friend of mine who I talked with earlier today, is the fact that society's ideology seeks to unite, all the people in that society toward one common purpose. And in the case of the U.S., that ideology comes from the capitalist class. And the purpose of all the laws and whatnot in that society is to unite all the people to thinking like, the capitalist bourgeoisie. And to some degree, some of us think that way to some degree greater than others. And that's where the class struggle again manifests itself amongst.
Okay, to our listening audience online, we're about to go over. You may lose us if you try calling in on 323-679-0841. Those who are online, you can continue to hear the discussion, but if you can't, please go to our archive back on to www.blogtalkradio.africa-on-the-move. Okay, let's continue. Next one, we'll go to Jabari. Your response, Jabari.
It's all a matter of us getting to the point of self-realization where we build strong institutions for ourselves and every aspect of our being is supported, point blank period. We have to get organized and we need to support each other and not see each other the same way that the oppressor sees us.
Okay. And do we have Brother Robert? Your response.
Yes. I'm going to hold off on this right now.
Okay.
I have a response. I have a response, if I may.
To Brother Paul? Yes, go
yes.
ahead.
I want to give a good example of something that we could easily do, and it's within our range and would not create an economic hardship for our community. Given the fact that ExxonMobil is the largest oil company in the world and makes the biggest amount of profits off of the oil, and a lot of that oil coming out of Africa, we could very easily organize within our own community a boycott on ExxonMobil. And if we did do that boycott on ExxonMobil and they were able to lose 15% of their sales, the way that ExxonMobil would try to get people to buy their gasoline is they would drop the price of their gasoline. And if they drop the price of their gasoline, all the other oil companies would do so as well. Because when ExxonMobil raises their price, so does the rest of the oil companies. When they drop their price, so does the rest of the oil companies. Because they know of the dominance of ExxonMobil. And then if we took the money that we saved by them dropping their price and used that money for a fund to really begin to start addressing. Millions of dollars to talk about building a program for change. And millions of dollars that could deal with such things as really being able to deal with expanding this media beyond just this show, where we can begin to map out and lay out the contradictions that confront our community domestically and internationally, and that we can then organize around a program to challenge the status quo as it has been set up to victimize people of African descent. I mean, that to me would be one clear, straight-up program that we could do. Too often I hear people who get upset with the gasoline prices and they call for a boycott for one day. What would the oil company care about us stopping to buy gasoline for one day? They know that you're going to have to fill up the day before the boycott and probably fill up the day after. So they will still make their profit. But if we decided to do a sustained boycott against ExxonMobil, the largest oil company that is linked with some of the major banks in this world that are carrying out the atrocities against the people of African descent, in particular in Nigeria, we could have a major impact on changing how big business deals with our community.
Brother Paul, in closing, who are some of the major banks that are a part of this genocide process that you can share with the audience, banks and companies, that we need to take a look at from your perspective?
Say that again. I didn't hear your question.
I said, who are some of the major banks and businesses that are profiting from these genocidal processes and acts that we can take a look at to maybe target from your perspective?
Good example. A bank that doesn't exist anymore but is owned by Wells Fargo was Wachovia. Wachovia money laundered over $378 billion worth of drug money, and often that drug money came out of our community for the Mexican Mafia. And the U.S. government, all they did was fine them $110 million, which was less than 2% of what they gained. That's step one. So we can look at not banking with Wells Fargo because of the benefits they gain out of it. Plus, in Baltimore, for example, Wells Fargo was sued because of their lending practices in the city of Baltimore and how they jacked up the prices on the black community on their loans. They did predatory loan practices right in the city of Baltimore. When we look at, as I said before, ExxonMobil, who has consistently participated in a number of coup d'etats and overthrow governments in countries like Nigeria, as they continue to rob and pollute the land of the Delta in Nigeria. That is another one that we can focus our attention on. When we look at Another good example is that we need to be clear on how our government operates. And I'm going to explain the relationship between this government of the U.S. and drugs. When the United States was heavily involved in Vietnam and Southeast Asia, those who are old enough can remember that 90% of all the heroin coming into the United States, 90% of all the heroin coming into the United States came from Southeast Asia. Those drugs stopped flowing into the United States as soon as the CIA and the U.S. military left Southeast Asia in 1978. Then you had the overthrow of Somoza in Nicaragua, and all of a sudden we start having a pipeline of cocaine coming into the United States from South America. The largest recipient of U.S. foreign aid today in South America is Colombia, and which everyone knows is the biggest source of cocaine coming into this country. But another thing happened was that when the government of Afghanistan was overthrown in 1978, and the Soviet Union came in to work with the government of Afghanistan, the United States started a major campaign in Afghanistan with the CIA, and as they started that campaign, heroin started being produced and coming into the United States from Afghanistan. And Afghanistan very rapidly replaced Southeast Asia as the major producer of heroin. When the Soviet Union collapsed and the Taliban took over the government of Afghanistan, they began to ask the United States for aid, and the United States insisted that Afghanistan get rid of its heroin, which it did. In fact, right after George W. Bush became president of the United States, one of the first international acts he did was to give $300 million to the government of Afghanistan because they had gotten rid of the heroin. That's in the beginning of 2001. By October 2001, here comes the United States and CIA again back into Afghanistan after September the 11th. And lo and behold, within a year, Afghanistan rapidly became the major producer of heroin again in the world, where they produce over 90% of the heroin in this world. So we need to look and see what is the connection between U.S. military and the CIA and the drugs that enter into our community, in which they use those drugs to put on excessive sentencing on our community, where they use those drugs to arm the police to the teeth in our community, where they use those drugs to destroy many of our families. We need to ask the question, how is it that our government seems to always be militarily and CIA involved in the very parts of the world where the drugs come from, and how is it that those drugs can make it across the border by the tons into this country and into our community? These are questions we need to ask ourselves. Obviously, you can't find a Cuban cigar on the corner up the streets in our community, but you certainly can find cocaine and heroin. So when the United States can put an embargo against Cuba, they can keep the cigars out of the United States, but they act like they can't keep the cocaine and heroin out of the United States. One has to ask the question, why is that? These are the kind of important questions that we need to understand the collaboration of the multinational corporations and banks with this government as it carries out an all-out assault against our community.
Okay, we're going to wrap it up. We're going to let each individual make a one-minute statement on a summary of what are some of the major things you would like to leave for your listening audience from the discussion day of dealing with genocide. Brother Moses, your final thoughts to the audience. What would you like to say to them?
Well, I want to say it's been a pleasure listening and being educated by some very astute and knowledgeable people. And I just want you to keep up the good work, and I'll hopefully be back again next week.
Thank you, brother. Sister Hattie, your final thoughts to our audience. What you would like to say to them?
I think that we just have to look at the unity piece. That's it, and some sanctions somewhere collectively. And I agree with everything that everybody is saying.
Thank you. Okay, Brother Paul, 1 minute, your final thought, what you would like to say to the listening audience.
I would like to say that everybody who's listening to this show should find 10 friends and encourage them to listen next week, because this show plays a major service to our community in getting information out that most of us do not hear about. And so I just like to encourage the listeners to not come on just by themselves next week, but have 10 other friends listen in with them as well, and then they can hold their discussion after the show is over.
Excellent. We thank you. And Brother Anthony and all the African people represented by the GC, what is your final thought or thoughts that you would like to share with our listening audience on the subject tonight?
I would like to thank you for allowing me to participate on the program with everybody else, and I would emphasize that it's important that when we hear of these of information about these atrocities that take place in our community, that we realize that that understand to connect it to what's going on in other parts, in other places inside the U.S. as well as outside, and start to recognize the patterns that occur, and also to join a political organization that's working for the liberation of your people, and get organized.
Okay, Brother Anthony, real quickly, for your organization, how can they get in contact with you? Get in contact with the organization, find out more about what your organization is doing in our communities.
Sure. We can be contacted at info@aaprp-gc.org. And our website is www.aaprp-gc.org.
Okay, Brother Paul, for your organization, how can they get in contact with your organization for people who'd like to find out more about it, how they can participate and help support your organization?
Yes. I would encourage people to go to our website, Friends of the Congo. That's www.friendsofthecongo.org. I also would encourage people that they could also go and look at the documentary we put together on the Congo, and that is on the web at congojustice.org. That's www.congojustice.org. Those are two ways I would encourage people to find out more information.
And we also would like to acknowledge Brother Hackey with the African Women Association. Those who would like to find out more information about the organization, they can always write them at African_Awareness_Association@Yahoo. And the African Women Association will be taking a travel challenge to Cuba from December 18 to January the 4th. If interested in going or you'd like to support the organization, you can email them or you can call 804-549-7492. We'd like to thank all our participants, Brother Robert Moses, Brother Zimbabwe Robinson, Sister Hattie, Afton Wim, Paul Pumphrey. And if we left anyone else out, I apologize. But we'd like to say, as always, we thank you for allowing us the opportunity to come to your home tonight. And we'll be back next week, same time, same station. And like Brother Paul stated, please share this information with a friend and let them know. We're on next Sunday, and this is one of the very few shows that would speak truth to power and give you analysis that will be based upon your historical conditions and upcoming. You know, all people have a history. We must use our history as our guide. So on behalf of African Awareness Association, we'd like to thank you again, and we'll be looking forward to seeing you next week. And remember that this genocidal process has not just started. This has been systematic, and now that we dissect the problem objectively and correctly, we will never be able to come up with a solution. Until next time, let's always remember to strive to go forward ever and backwards never. You have been listening to Africa on Move. As your host, Brother Africa, we see you next week. Forward to Africa.
Latitude zero, longitude zero, planned by the Creator. Sesanthropus was the first man found on the earth. That earth was the motherland, Africa. We know that without total understanding of what happened in the past, it would be difficult to relate to the future. We know that within the structure of the music, there should be a message, and the message should be truth. So now, we give you Africa, the center of the world.